Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans.
Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson, Mike Costantino sitting across from me. Still
he is right
like
here
Mike.
Trying a low-slung approach. I'm sitting lower in the seats. I got the microphone turned down. I'm kind of a low-riding today.
So there's 7 billion people on the planet.
There are,
Mike.
Yeah, more or less.
7 billion people. What are the odds that any one of those people will be our guest on the show today?
It's incalculable.
One in 7 billion, Mike. One in 7 billion. And the other thing that's really a coincidence is this particular guest today happens to be my brother.
What about that 6 degrees of separation? I guess.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of brothers, so this guy here is it.
Welcome, Chuck.
Yes, Chuck. You want to say a few words in Vietnamese for us?
This is Chuck Williamson.
See, when everybody else was studying French and German, he was studying Vietnamese in graduate school. Because he wanted to learn the language.
Graduate school of the U.S. Army.
Yeah.
Oh, that graduate school.
Yeah. And I hear there was a rumor that people were trying to blow you up over there in Vietnam while you were speaking Vietnamese.
Well, yes, they did blow up our mess hall, so I ended up with rations for the last 6 months I was there.
And when Chuck got back from Vietnam, he went right into banking, as our father had been in banking and our grandfather, right?
Yes, right.
And so tell us a little bit about him. Mike, you've got his little short resume there.
Yes, well, he was a chief investment officer for a different financial corporation. He was for two different banks. Tell us about those.
Well, most of my career was spent with First Interstate Bank, which is now part of the Wells Fargo.
Which we had right here on Forest Avenue and for a long time. Well, Old Sedona Residence.
Right where the chamber is, yes.
Right where the chamber is.
And you were
the
chief investment officer?
For a 7-state region for First Interstate Bank. And before that, I was chief financial officer of the affiliate in Oklahoma, First Interstate Oklahoma.
And you handled a measly $12 billion in investments?
Yes, we had a large pool of money to invest, and so I have handled some very big portfolios, both in the trust activity, which is mostly equities and bonds and stuff, and in the bank's own portfolio, which was primarily mortgage-backed securities, the kind that got us all into trouble recently.
So it's Chuck's fault, by the way.
Yeah, we were going to ask Chuck, what role you had in the economic crash of 2008.
Yes. Well, I have to admit I was already retired by then, so I won't take direct blame for the decisions that were made that triggered it, but I will admit to campaigning and lobbying for repeal of Glass-Steagall for almost my whole career. And so when that succeeded, they neglected to put much in place to regulate the activity. So that may have contributed to it indirectly. But I had retired by then, so I didn't make any of the actual decisions.
And the bank sent you to Washington to lobby and the whole thing?
Yes, I lobbied for Glass-Steagall repeal in Washington, and I belonged to organizations whose sole function was to try to get it repealed and so on. So, yes.
You were very successful in getting it repealed.
Yes. So I do take a little blame for the changes that weren't that may have made sense by themselves, but the regulations to control the risk just didn't follow.
In other words, when they repealed Glass-Steagall, then there was nothing put in to replace. It was old-fashioned.
For the people who aren't familiar with the Glass-Steagall are the same. I mean, many of you probably weren't born when this controversy started. After the crash in 29, Congress came up with rules that separated commercial banking and the kind of retail banking that you think of as your local branch from investment banking, which does the securities trading and dealing and so on. There were some areas that banks could still do involving treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities and municipal bonds. So banks still had some investment activities, but they couldn't do stocks. They couldn't do – now, of course, at the time, many of these derivatives that caused the problem didn't even exist. So no one thought to regulate them. When we got Glass-Steagall repealed, it meant that bank holding companies – could buy brokerage firms
and vice versa.
And that happened, and so there was a huge consolidation in the business. Later, insurance companies bought banks. And so the whole financial service industry ended up in the form of bank holding companies regulated by the Federal Reserve. And the banks themselves were still regulated in a different way through the Comptroller of Currency. But the holding company activity, all this huge variety of activity, was regulated by the Fed.
And when the whole thing begins to collapse, it's the bank holding companies that have the problem, not so much core banking part of the industry or what?
Right. There were no serious core banking problems. The Comptroller of Currency, who regulates national banks, has an excellent examination staff, very tight rules. It's not easy for a bank to get in trouble. They do sometimes, but most of the problems occurred in this crisis at the holding company level, which is regulated by the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve during this most of this period was had a chairman, Alan Greenspan, who really didn't believe in regulation. So in effect, they were sort of self-regulatory environment. So everybody, the underlying theory in what he's quoted as saying is the owners and managers of banks will look out to the shareholders' interest. We don't really need to do much to control them because they'll all be working in the shareholders' interest.
It's almost like a religion in certain economic schools, isn't it? That the free market will take care of everything. No regulation is needed. No, even not much oversight is needed. In fact, isn't the rule the more oversight, the more government involvement you have, the worse everything is going to be?
Well, of course, that is what some people would like you to believe. I was on the side of arguing that case, but of course, in the reality, it's nonsense. Not only are we protected by systemic risk from regulations, like the potential collapse of massive parts of the banking system. Regulations can prevent that, but also the assumption that somehow bank managers always work in the shareholders' interest is an oversimplification. So recently, one of the largest banks in the country fired the person who was in effect my counterpart when I was working, who managed the treasury activity at that bank because they took a $2 billion loss.
Jamie Dimon by name. We can name names here. We're not afraid.
Yes. So Chase Bank took an unexpected $2 billion loss in the same area that I
managed. And it was
managed.
In treasuries. It wasn't in the derivatives?
The treasury department.
The
problem
department.
Was in derivatives. And
it
so
was
she
derivatives.
Was managing what they called the treasury department. They misunderstood the risk they were taking, or I think there's an easier explanation. It's never become public is she was a profit center. There's just an axiom in investments is if you take no risk, you make no reward. If you have a profit center whose job it is to control, to manage and lower your risk, but their objective is to make a profit, you've created an impossible dynamic where what they do to increase profits is exactly the opposite of what they do to control risk. It's a nonsensical structure. So it was the structure the bank created that made her work for profits, be incented by profits. So the idea that they're always behaving in the shareholders' interest, well, most managers, and I spent my career as a bank executive and was on the executive committee of banks where the decisions were really made, we had to worry about making next year's budget. We all had stock options and things that gave us incentive that lasted over years, but the reality is you still had to make next year's budget. If you didn't make it a couple years in a row, it didn't matter about the options because you weren't working there anymore. So everyone in business, unless it's a closely held company, is focused on making next year's budget and short-term profits, which is not controlling risk.
So they're calling this the Great Recession or the a depression. I noticed Paul Krugman's calling it a depression. Now, the Great Depression wasn't the first of these collapses, the first of these great recessions, right?
That's right, Steve. We've had a whole history of them. The 19th century was full after one after another. And we know from our own family history, our great-grandfather owned a small bank in Honey Grove, Texas, as well as a mercantile firm and some other things. They had a panic, one of these series of panics and depressions in 1893, and his bank went bust. And that happened to 4,000 banks in that same year and 14,000 businesses in the United States. And the reason wasn't that they made bad loans is that They had runs. They had panics where people wanted to withdraw their money. Well, no bank can let all the customers line up and take out their money. They've made investments. They've made loans with it. They don't have it.
What happened in Oklahoma City? Wasn't there a run after that? Our
grandfather worked for a bank, the American First Bank in Oklahoma City, which is now part of Bank of America system. And they had another panic in 1909. And this is not just a made-up
So there's
phrase.
One panic after
oh, yes.
another.
So just before just the
on
Federal
and
Reserve,
on banks collapsing.
All the time. Yeah, that happened every 20 years.
Before
that,
the Federal Reserve. Collapse,
yeah. So banks had started failing as a result of runs in 09 all over the country. It was a similar crisis where people lost confidence in their bank and wanted to withdraw their money. The manager of American First Bank in Oklahoma City, which was the largest bank in the state at the time, before the bank opened, he saw a line forming outside the bank. He took all the empty money bags from the vault and went around to the hardware stores and bought every washer in Oklahoma City, filled the money bags with washers from the hardware stores, and had four guards arrive in a wagon and unload it. The crowd dispersed, and his bank was one of the few that survived the runs.
That's a great story. And it's a good story because it shows how emotionally driven, not economically driven or not reason driven, so much of this is. What's going to Eurozone? Yeah, so
if we talk about what's happening, why there's a bailout for the Spanish banks right now going on in the
exactly.
Euro, it's a run.
Exactly.
It's the same thing. People
exactly.
have lost confidence in the banks. Now, they may have serious problems. I don't know if they're solvent or not in the long run. But the crisis they face right now, and the same crisis they face in Greece, a lot of it is a liquidity crisis. And our Federal Reserve here dealt with the liquidity crisis in a very good way during the 2007-8 crisis. They did cover the liquidity. They may not have been any good at regulating the risk or leaning against the wind, or as one of the previous Bill Martin said, one of the previous Fed chairmen, is their job is to take away the punch bowl when the party really gets going. That is to slow the economy when things are beginning to get out of control. They didn't do that at all. They didn't believe it in that under Greenspan. But
Greenspan didn't believe there was a housing bubble, right?
He did not believe that. He may not have believed it at all. He's quoted as saying, but he didn't believe even if there was, it was his job to do anything about it because markets solve all problems. And that naive philosophy led to a lot of the problems that we face now. The unemployment and things are based on this silly view that everything is solved by the markets.
Yeah, we've been dancing around this. Texas representative and presidential candidate Ron Paul blames the Federal Reserve for the financial bubble whose collapse caused this current difficulties.
But there were recession before recession. Again and again and again, before the Great Recession, that the Federal Reserve was...
The Federal Reserve has an important role, and I think if we hadn't had the Federal Reserve available to provide liquidity, we would currently be in a situation worse than the Greeks, worse than the Italians. They have 25-30% unemployment. We would have at least that, because you would have saw credit disappear. The banks would have collapsed. There'd be no loans. They would be liquidating all the banks. FDIC would have covered small depositors, but that doesn't help big corporations. So big corporations that had commercial paper and assets and things in banks would have lost huge chunks of it. So without the Fed, this crisis would have been a depression.
And so, somebody said the problem in Europe is there's no Fed for all the countries, right?
Unfortunately, they have a European Central Bank, but each country has its own bank as well, and they don't have a common strategy. So it's a very flawed structure that they ended up creating with the common market and common currency. They didn't put the infrastructure together to make it work very well. So what's happened recently is Angela Merkel in Germany has opposed a lot of the bailouts and limited their size and so on, and is following an austerity program in Germany. But it hasn't worked. The idea that it's sort of like the Ryan budget. If you really cut all the things in the Ryan budget, we would slip immediately into another recession. If we don't do anything about the cliff that we've created, this artificial, nonsensical thing about the tax increases and spending cuts that will go in at year end, if we don't do anything about it, we will absolutely be in a recession next year. So they've created an environment where their response to the crisis has made collection of revenue worse and the need to bail out institutions in the southern tier of Europe worse. So I think they've backed away from that now. They've created some environments where they will help the banking system in Spain and so on. But they've made one mistake after the other, and it's the same mistake that you hear called for here, is that somehow austerity is the answer.
Does Mitt Romney have the answer?
Well, we joked about this before the meeting. I have he has 17 years experience in investments and bank capital, and I have 30 years. Does that make me more qualified? The answer is business experience is almost irrelevant. The only president in my lifetime with business experience was Harry Truman, and he was a failed clothing store. So it's really getting things done in Washington that matters. So the most successful presidents, whether they did the right thing or not in getting things done, are ones with a lot of congressional experience, or they've at least managed a government entity like a state, which he has. But the actual business experience, our motivations and ways of doing things, if I wanted somebody that reported to me to do something, I told them and they went off and did it. That doesn't work for Congress. So the kinds of ways of dealing with things, even the accounting regulations, are totally different. So the idea that somehow I have some business experience that I would make a good president is nonsensical. I'd be a horrible president.
Well, address job for you. You are my brother, you know, and I don't have a lot of brothers.
You're the only one.
Address job creation in that same context.
Well, I have to admit, I was working in banking during a time of consolidation.
Yeah.
So
consolidation doesn't sound like job.
I could say I was a job creator. There were times when I opened new offices and hired a bunch of new people to do new things and new activities. But also there were times like I went up to Reno and totally closed the office with 40 people up there, and I made big changes in our Denver affiliate and so on. So I cannot claim during my career I created more jobs than I eliminated. I never paid any attention to that. The decisions were strictly based on what made more money and more sense for the company.
So that's true of Romney's firm, right?
Yes. I mean, it's not anything we even counted, so he can't answer the question, and I couldn't answer the question if I hired more people than I fired.
So,
I don't know.
So if Bain Capital was in the forefront of exporting jobs somewhere else, that's just business, right?
Well, yes, we wouldn't think anything about it if it made money. He made $200 to $300 million doing this. Is he going to worry about somebody's job? Of course not. But neither would I have worried about your
job. Some pundits are.
I might have felt guilty about firing people I knew. I admit, and was uncomfortable with it, but it was my job. I did it.
Yeah.
And that's how the system, when you have the hat of being a banker, running a business, all you're interested in is the logic of being, that's very different from being the president or a governor or even the mayor of a town. Right?
I don't even think they're very close. So the idea that business experience makes you a good politician, most of our politicians have been attorneys. I'm not sure that's a good idea either, but the reality is we've had very few presidents that had any business experience. And I don't know whether that's an advantage to him, but I don't think it is. I think most of them's advantage comes from either being a governor and administering a state, which is similar to a federal government in some ways, or having a long experience in Congress where they know how to get things done.
So you don't think austerity will work? Putting in the Ryan budget, so good.
In the long term, we do have to deal with the deficits, but there are two variables. One is how does your revenue grow, and the other is how do your expenses grow or get controlled?
Right.
An improving economy reduces our expenditures for unemployment and all sorts of other benefits. And so you get into a favorable environment where you're helping the economy by reducing government expenditures automatically because unemployment goes down, food stamps go down, a lot of other programs go down in an improving economy. And the opposite happens if you trigger a recession. So that's the problem in Europe. They've triggered recessions in all the southern tier of Europe. And the revenues are dropping and the expenditures are going up. Because if you lay somebody off, they don't pay taxes anymore. They receive money. So the end result is you do have to deal with the long-term deficits. If the people who firmly believe that markets have all the answers should realize that we don't have to deal with the deficits now because we have the lowest interest rates in my lifetime. The markets are saying you don't have a deficit problem today. We got downgraded as a country by S&P, but that's being used for political BS. But if you actually read what Standard & Poor's said about the downgrade, it was based on the political impact. The fact that Congress wouldn't approve the debt limit. That's why we were downgraded, because they thought our government was dysfunctional, not because we had too big a deficits.
But our government is actually very functional, right, John?
Well, they may be right. I'm not saying they were wrong that we're dysfunctional. We do have a problem, and I guess we're going to face another crisis, an artificial crisis like this later this year. That will trigger a Moody's downgrade. And
so what happens is people get laid off, and then they don't have as much money, and then they don't spend as much money. Now, if you're an individual, you cut back your spending. But if the whole town is filled with people who are laid off and everybody stops spending, then all the businesses and stuff begin to see a big shortfall in money. They just don't have it. And also government, even if government doesn't increase spending a bit, their costs keep going up, right?
So Americans got to a point where their debts were too high. They had artificially spent money from this housing bubble, and so they need to deal with that. So individuals need to deal with their debt problem. But if the government tries to deal with it, debt problem at the same time, you exaggerate all this.
So Dean Baker, who we've had on the show a couple of times now, says that, the economist Dean Baker said that there was an $8 trillion ephemeral housing wealth created by the bubble, led to a huge surge in consumption, right?
Yeah.
Tens of millions of people borrowed against the bubble-generated equity in their houses. But when the bubble collapsed, I guess $8 trillion disappeared from that was stimulating the economy, disappeared.
Let's talk about business-friendly. I remember this character in The Godfather down in Cuba. He talked about how this government knows how to treat business. Of course, he's talking about a fascist regime. Of Batista, before,
you know. No, merely a military dictatorship.
Excuse me. And so what is business friendly? How business friendly should government be?
Well, on the investment side of things, what we look for is stability and predictability more than anything else. So if you have a Congress
people. Could you say that again, please?
We
slowly.
Want stability and predictability to make our plans.
You.
So if you have a Congress that's going to artificially trigger a debt crisis and cause a default in the federal government's debt.
For political purposes.
That's got to worry you. I mean, so if you have create an artificial cliff at the end of the year where you don't know if your taxes are going to go up and the spending is going to drop dramatically by the federal government. If you create a crisis, if you need to do that in order to government, you scare the hell out of businesses. They don't want to invest. They don't want to move forward. What you need is a government that you can understand and predict. You don't have to have one that acts in your favor all the time, but you at least have to have some rationale.
I know you're skeptical about predictions, and
the private
sector has been increasing now for quarter after quarter after quarter. Public sector's cut back workers and so forth and so on. What do you think will be the impact of if things really go south in Europe on our economy?
And what is the nature of prediction?
Yes.
Please predict, and then just tell us about predictions.
It's one thing to predict if that happens later this year. They're our largest trading partner. If they go into a massive recession across Europe, we will too next year. But it's a whole different thing to say our deficits are too big and Social Security will be bankrupt in 20 years. If you look at the assumptions people are making, tiny variabilities in the assumptions make small differences when you're talking about the end of the year, and enormous differences 5 years from now. I never even worked for a business that planned more than 5 years ahead. So to make predictions about things like Social Security, you're making assumptions about the level of employment, how many people retire early and versus work longer than normal. You're making all sorts of assumptions that make anything you say nonsensical.
So they're saying in 2035 or 2030, sorry, it varies from year to year, right, depending on the economy, that Social Security will start out paying out just 75% of its benefits. But you don't think that's a serious prediction.
I think people who are telling you that are saying something political. They're not saying something based on statistics.
They want to cut Social Security, and they need a reason.
They want to privatize Social Security, which has been on the agenda for 25 years. The Bush administration wanted to make it a non-government entity where you put your own money in like a 401k, and that's been the Koch brothers and the political agenda for a decade or more. That's what they want to do, and that's a different scenario with Medicare. I'm not saying they're the same, but Social Security is not something we have to deal with now. Medicare is a very difficult problem because we don't know the impact of the changes in the laws and all the stuff. And if you just project trends of increasing costs for medical care and look at the demographics, you get horrible numbers. But we don't know if that's true. We don't know if the government will do things to limit the growth and so on. So I don't know if those predictions are accurate, but I would say the Social Security is just a waste of your time to worry about it.
Politically, it seems like the Republicans are sabotaging every part of the Affordable Care Act, which they call Obamacare, that will limit cost. It's like they don't want it to work to limit cost. They don't. There are thousands of these little mechanisms and studies and the example is like aspirin, right? You have two medicines and aspirin works better than the medicine that costs you 45 times as much. So there's little comparative studies and so forth and so on.
Well, yeah, I'm going to take
go ahead, Mike.
The packages, the food stamps and whatnot, we've already talked about that go up and down and unemployment. Keeps 40 million people out of poverty in the United States. Keeps them spending money, keeps them going to the grocery store, keeps them buying cars, keeps them doing all that stuff. 40 million people out of poverty helped by these programs. The 16 million people who now have medical care. So the healthy 16 million people that Obamacare is keeping healthy and keeping them working, keeping them paying taxes. It seems like not a bad return on investment, Mr. Businessman.
Well, I have to say that looking at economics, there's a few things I believe, a lot of it I'm skeptical of, but one thing I do believe is supply and demand. And so if you look at the price and supply of medical services, what I would do to control the cost is increase the supply. Let's say let there be a program that doubled the number of positions in medical schools and nursing schools, and let the government give scholarships if they were willing to work in underserved areas for 10 years and so on. And so if you increase the supply of people in the medical business, you'll reduce the cost. But none of that is on the table. I don't know of any. The only thing I know that they're doing to reduce the cost is these comparative studies of various treatments to see if they work or not. And even that, it's all voluntary if you decide to go with a new standard.
Yeah, there's no.
Imagine that, increasing supply to drive down to reduce cost.
But you remain skeptical of all these. You listen to thousands over your career, prediction by different economists. You had economists at your banks you worked for. You had economists that you read. And I don't want to say that they're all equal, but you became skeptical of the predictions.
What I've found is many economists, and they usually predict the same thing, are good at predicting the next 6 months. But they almost always miss the major events, like the housing crash. A few of them get those, but usually those are the ones that predict the crisis year after year when it finally occurs. Because the truth is, nobody's any good at predicting when a bubble burst. And that was true of the dot-com bubble. Clearly those stocks were overvalued. Nobody I knew in investments believed they were worth that amount. But that doesn't mean that the bubble's going to burst right now. The same way with the housing. Diana and I visited San Diego during the height of the housing deal, and the paper said only 18% of the people in San Diego County can afford the average house. Well, that's obviously not sustainable. You can't have only 18 people. So it meant some gimmick was going on to let them in houses they couldn't afford.
It was inflated. I mean, you can actually look at the charts in retrospect. We're about out of time, folks. Next week we have three of the 7 billion people coming on the show. The LD6 candidates. LD6 is a new legislative district that includes Sedona and the Verde Valley, Flagstaff, and a whole big chunk.
You have three very good candidates this season. We're going to introduce you to them next week if you haven't seen them already. I do want to say that this can be found on vvid.org. like a lot of our discussions, it's a little dense. And Chuck here, Chuck Williamson, brother of Steve Williamson, has given us, we'd like to think, a lot of insight today into the financial world on a personal basis. And we really appreciate it, Chuck. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us, folks.
Enjoyed it.